it's Jim Brown here with another edition of the Outrig Capercast. This is number 21, and we're going to talk about racing. I have vowed not to turn this shindig into a periodical of current events, but just last week, Christmas Day, there was some remarkable history made in the name of modern seafaring. A 48-year-old Frenchman named Thomas Colville, sailing in a 102-foot trimaran, completed his single-handed circumnavigation, one man, one boat, around the world, non-stop, in 49 days. His average speed was 24 knots. Now that's the average. Remember, he had to cross through the doldrums twice, which is a lot of sitting in light air sailing. So to average 24 knots for 49 days, at times he had to be going almost twice that fast. And he broke the previous record by about a week. And that record was set by another Frenchman, François Joyon, just a couple of years ago, 57 days. Now it turns out that only three people have achieved this single-handed circumnavigation non-stop in a modern vessel. The third person, the original and the real benchmark for this course, was set by a petite young woman, Ellen MacArthur, also sailing a big French trimaran. Her time was 71 days. Now that was back in 2008, and at that time, nobody, not even in France, thought that it was possible to sail around the world nonstop single-handed in less than Jules Verne's 80 days. And Ellen was almost a diminutive young woman, 28 years old. And it was such an astounding achievement that still today the French just idolize Ellen MacArthur. And yet the really significant thing about these three single-handed dashes around the world is that in just 8 years, the time has been reduced from 71 days to 49 days. And that is an enormous technological advance. And speaking of technology, the same thing is going on right now in monohull racing. In the fixture that the French call the Vendée Globe, which is for single-hull vessels only and with a full crew, right now as I'm speaking, there are probably several of these big skimming disc type monohulls sailing around Cape Horn. No one has finished the race yet, but the same guy, François Joyon, who until Christmas Day held the previous single-handed record at 57 days, he's in the crew of one of these monohulls, and they have had some tremendous runs. 5 days at over 800 miles per day. Now, when I started sailing back in the 1950s, a 200-mile day was practically unheard of. And in one of these recent 5-day runs, Joyon achieved 870 miles in one 24-hour period. Now, they're down there in the Southern Ocean, running hard under spinnaker in huge waves. The boats are of the skimming disc type, so they tend to plane, and they are also hydrofoil stabilized. They're not foil-borne, that is, they don't come right up out of the water and fly on their hydrofoils, but they get stability from them. And incidentally, the trimaran racers are also foil-assisted, that is, they don't come up and fly all three hulls clear of the surface. But when the trimarans get going, they fly the main hull anyway. They are flying two of the three hulls. And the third hull, the downwind float that's in the water, it's also foil-assisted. That is, most of the weight of the vessel is being carried on the hydrofoil, and the float is simply skimming the surface so as to provide fore and aft stability. So many of these vessels are either hydrofoil-stabilized or hydrofoil-assisted. And I'm confident that it won't be long before we see 1,000 miles in 24 hours. Now, of course, that was Arthur Piver's old dream way back in the 60s. He was talking about taking one of his little plywood box trimarans down into the roaring 40s, catching one of those giant waves and maintaining surf riding speed so that he could achieve 1,000 nautical miles in a 24-hour period. That was a bombastic, brash, braggadocio thing for him to say at the time. But let's face it, again, Arthur Piver was a visionary. He could see this coming. But it has taken the French to make this happen. Their nautical heritage is very strong, and ever since the Napoleonic Wars, they've had a real vendetta with the English. You know, the British Admiral Lord Nelson really nailed the French fleet at Trafalgar, and the French have been sore about it ever since, but they're really showing the world their stuff these days in modern lightweight seafaring. And sailing is really big in France. You know, their sailors are like our quarterbacks. When someone like Ellen MacArthur comes back from her marvelous achievement, she gets a ticker tape parade down the Champs-Élysées. Now, personally, I've never been all that interested in racing, and I'm much relieved that neither of my sons has become caught up in it. Especially this single-handed stuff when the vessels are proceeding at flank speed with no one on watch. You know, the single guy down below sawing wood while his boat is ripping through the waves and through who knows what else. I've always thought that it was downright unseamanlike. But I am really taken with these technological advances. Just in the last few days, the Vendée Globe boats have had a fair amount of crash and burn going on. And over the years, in order to achieve these advances, there have been a fair number of collisions and capsizes and dramatic rescues, boats lost, lives lost. When the great Mike McMullen was lost at sea, I remember Dick Newick saying, well, if they're going to play these rough games, somebody's going to get hurt. But that's what it takes. It's this kind of bravado, this sense of competition, the ego invested and the money invested. The reason the French have dominated ocean racing for, the last 30 years is because their booze manufacturers and banks, etc., are willing to put up the dough to make these things happen. It pays off for them. Maybe that kind of thing will happen in America one day, but not so long as we have football, NASCAR, boxing, where a lot of folks get hurt playing rough games. And with nothing much to show for it, the thing about sailing is that humankind is learning how to really harness the power of the wind for transportation. And if that sounds touchy-feely, well, let me say that I know of at least two efforts that are being mounted right now in order to produce sailing vessels that can go head-to-head in commercial competition with ferry boats and inter-island airlines for carrying people and packages. And it's very interesting to me that these efforts have chosen multi-hulls as the vessel type of choice for commercial service in lightweight cargoes. And make no mistake, it has been the racing that has put the know-how on the shelf for undertaking these new quests. And as I've explained in a previous podcast, I came into sailing on a commercial level, that is, these charter boats that I was sailing in around the Caribbean carrying skin diving and sailing parties, and sometimes carrying the local people, you know, one of their small boats or their refrigerator or a washing machine, carrying cargo around, trading fish for food in various places. That level, wherein the boat sustains the owner rather than the other way around, it was that level on which I came into sailing, and it has stuck with me ever since. But I couldn't afford a 150-foot steel staysail schooner, and I didn't know anyone who could, so I started designing, you know, trimarans. The Sea Runner trimarans in particular were really intended for this so-called seasteading lifestyle. They were, and still are, highly specialized workboats, in my view. I do not personally claim to have ever lived the seasteading lifestyle, except around the edges. When I did my cruising with my family, we had sufficient funds. We didn't have a lot, but we had enough to go and go and go. And consequently, I was never really very interested in racing. Although, back in the very early 60s, I did build a rather racy little trimaran, a 27-footer we called Caravel. She was designed and built for a client, a corporate client, And a kindly old gent. We had high hopes of, going into production and all that. We were so naive, and I was so premature. I had a very meager understanding of yacht design by that time. Did everything by eye, couldn't even draw a displacement curve. Consequently, the boat turned out to be very high in the bow. That is, she floated way too high in the forebody. We had to put chunks of window sash lead up in the bow to try to bring her down. And she had extremely asymmetric floats. It was, really a very radical contraption. But it had a good rig in it. I copied what Bill Lapworth was doing at the time. And she had a good, big, deep dagger board and a nice rudder. And she would go like a scalded dog. We sailed out of Santa Cruz, California at the time. There were two yacht clubs on Monterey Bay, one in Santa Cruz and one down in Monterey. And they had an active racing schedule for the combined fleets. And I asked if we could sail our caravel unofficially in one of their races so as to try to figure out what we had there. We knew she was fast inshore, but they have a race called the Round the Bay Race. Monterey Bay is a big, shallow bight in the coast, about 10 miles by 20 miles. And, now I'm beginning to wonder if perhaps I've told this story on a podcast before. Well, that's okay. Probably there are some who haven't heard it. It turned out to be kind of a pivotal point in my life. So we sailed the 20 miles from Santa Cruz down to Monterey to enter this race, which started there in Monterey. And the first mark of the course was a sea buoy off of Monterey. That is, the first leg of the race was the windward leg, all right. And we had a rather raucous beat against a 20-knot northwester, the standard summer afternoon California sailing breeze. We started dead last, got out into the waves, found out that we were much more powerful than most of the monohulls. We were able to sail through the fleet, all except for their scratch boat, which was a beautiful 50-foot, a so-called 8-meter, very narrow, deep, very close-winded monohull called Angelita, famous yacht, former Olympian. And we went nipping at the heels of Angelita for 20 miles, just bashing away. We could keep up with her, but she was so close-winded that we couldn't get by her. Whenever we threatened to try to sail around her windward side, she'd head up and just make us head up. And because we were so much smaller, and to us the waves were so much bigger, we just could not get around her on the windward side. And it was a raucous beat, boy. In the crew, we had my late great friend Jim McCaig, and a high school kid who was the owner's son, and he was learning. And we had James Banks, who was a 250-pound big black biker. His foul weather gear were his motorcycle's leathers. And on this beat to windward, we could really use his weight. So we had this figured out. Because the boat was so buoyant in the bow, we fastened two trunk handles on the float deck, both sides, but we were here on the port tack, and Banksy baby could get out there and ride the float bow like he was riding a motorcycle or riding a horse and hang on to these trunk handles with his hair streaming back in the gale, soaking wet. We were a sight, I guess. This was long before GPS, of course, and we couldn't quite see across the bay that 20 miles, and so we didn't know how we were doing on the course line. I figured it was best to just stay right behind Angelita. She probably knew where she was going. And as we approached the weather end of the course, of course, we began to see the headland sticking out at Santa Cruz, and McCaig, our navigator, convinced me that we were coming in high on the mark, that we had room to bear off. So that meant that we could probably sail down to the leeward side of Angelita far enough to get out of her wind shadow and maybe sneak through. And in the process, I saw one of the grandest sights that I have ever seen in the ocean. As we sailed through Angelita's lee, the sun was going down behind her. She was backlighted, and her crew was so chagrined to be passed up by this little trimaran that they were driving her unreasonably hard. We were maybe 500 feet to leeward of her, and both boats were bounding up and down in a 6 or 7 foot, open ocean seaway. Banks was beside himself, whooping and hollering, and Angelita was heeled so far over that at times it almost looked like we were looking down from the top of her mast. And as a matter of fact, now we could see that the foot of her Genoa was scooping up the wave tops, and water was washing halfway up the Genoa as seen backlighted in the sunset. Well, I knew that was pretty extreme. Remember now, this was at the time when the monohull, multihull Vendetta was pretty strong, early 1960s. But we now turned our attention to finding the weather-marked sea buoy off of Monterey, which was barely visible in the haze. And once I had it located, I turned back again to look at Angelita, and she was gone. I dropped the tiller, jumped up on the cabin top, looked back, and I finally could see her down among the waves. She had been dismasted. And I'll tell you, the sight of such a gallant yacht, so indisposed, just made me sick. It was a real kick in the groin. I knew she had a strong crew and an inboard engine, and she was not really in distress, so we kept going. Once they gathered up the pieces, it was a short run under power to get into her home port there at Santa Cruz, and I later learned that the yacht's owner had been asleep at that time. He was down in his bunk. He'd been steering all the way across the bay and went down to take a nap. It was his crew that put the boat in such a predicament. It wasn't our fault, but still, I just felt terrible about it. Well, we rounded the mark at dusk and headed back for Monterey. I didn't know how we were going to do downwind. All the other yachts had downwind sails, spinnakers and stuff, and we didn't have any of that. But we knew that they were far behind. We had left them in the dust early on, and we could see nothing of them now. So we sailed on and finished the race at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And when we passed the race committee there on the end of Monterey Wharf, somebody shouted down, "That's nice, but you don't count." And that was true. We didn't count, and we had no business trying to race multi-hulls against monohulls. They had been generous to allow us to sail along. We had been unsportsmanlike, and the dismasting definitely diminished our position in the local sailing community. It was a bad mistake. I did very little racing after that. I did have a chance to crew with John Marples in his 37-foot sea runner Bacchanal in some of those Monterey Bay races. He was training to take his boat and his crew in the multi-hull Transpac, that is, from Los Angeles to Honolulu. That was a race for multi-hulls only. I was glad he was going to do it. I couldn't go with him. We were just getting ready to leave on our trip in Scrimshaw. And it turned out that Marples won that race. It's quite a story on how it happened. Most of the fleet dropped out with equipment failures. And we have a good video interview with John telling the story of that race. But I learned more about it from the same Jim McCaig, who had been my navigator and was the navigator in the race for John. McCaig had been a B-29 navigator during the Korean War. And because he's not here to tell the story himself, I'll tell you what he told me about the 1972 multi-hull Transpac race when he sailed as navigator in the 37-foot sea runner Bacchanal, owned and built by John Marples.
Hey, you, Jimmy, who are running over time.
Oh yeah, we talked about this. Some of the listeners are asking for longer caper casts. I'm going to throw in another little story here because it belongs here. It's just a few minutes. And let's hope they let you know if they like it.
Okay, break your own rules. Your listeners can always just turn you off, even if I can't.
Well, dang it all, you keep interrupting. I'm trying to tell about John Marple's 1972 multi-hull Transpac. Here we go. Now, after the start near Los Angeles, there is a mark in the course that requires the boats to sail around the northern end of Catalina Island. And that's upwind, but after getting out into the big blue ocean, The boats normally have to lollygag in reaches and variable weather until getting out into the trade winds. It takes 2 or 3 days to get out into the open trades. And the rest of the race is almost a dead run for over 2,000 miles. They call it the downhill pull. I've made that voyage, although not while racing, and I can tell you it's some of the most glorious sailing ever. Running in the trades, normally 15 to 20 knots of wind day and night with plenty of fetch, so the waves have time to build up and become very mature. And while monohulls can tend to roll badly on downhill courses, this is just ideal stuff for multi-hulls. So as McCaig explained, the object was now to try to get the boat to go as fast as possible in these beautiful conditions. Now, most multi-hulls or any lightweight planing vessel can catch these waves and surf like crazy until I get down into the valley of the waves and then try to climb the crest ahead, which at that time was not often done. And so with a seaway that was moving at, say, 15 to 18 knots, what normally happened was that the boat would sail in spurts of speed. When surfing down the faces of the waves, the speed would surge up toward and even exceed 20 knots. Whereas when trying to climb up the back of the wave ahead, the speed would drop back to something like 10 knots. But of course, there was a lot more going on. Latecomer listeners might wish to go back to some of the early caper casts when I talked about our very pioneering experience in the little Wanna trimaran sailing down the California coast. It took us a while to learn that the water at the crest of the waves was running with the wave, whereas the water just ahead of the crest, that is down the face of the wave, was coming back. It was actually tucking underneath the crest, which caused reversing currents in the wave. And so when, at the very moment when the boat was propelled forward at its fastest by gravity in the crest, we ran into water that was coming the other way. Well, the same thing, of course, was going on with the Marple's crew in the Bacchanal, but it was a somewhat bigger boat and a somewhat more experienced crew by then, and so it wasn't all quite so strange to them, but still it was a question of trying to figure out what's going on within the seaway. Well, now, an individual wave has a relatively short life. Individual wave builds up, it might be, I don't know, 75 feet long, maybe 150 feet long, and it rolls along as a crest for a while until the back current comes underneath the crest enough to cause it to crash on over itself, and then the energy is dissipated in the surface as a whole bunch of white water, and the wave subsides. But at the same time, there's another wave, probably two or three other waves, that are developing off to the right or left of this individual, and they are going through their perturbation cycles of mounding up and cresting and breaking, falling down their own faces, and subsiding. And these waves are diagonally before or behind, to the left or to the right, of this individual that we're speaking of. And according to my old friend Jim McCaig, it was Bill Lee who figured out that in order to keep their boat surfing continually all the time, they had to hop diagonally from one wave to the other. Let's say they have caught one wave and they're diving off going like the dickens, and now's the time to decide whether they can hop to the right or left in order to get onto another wave so as that they're not trying ever to climb the wave ahead of them. And McCaig, the navigator, figured out that it was Bill Lee who was buying him the most miles on his watch. So McCaig asked Bill Lee to tell the other crew how in the world to steer this boat so that they could keep it surfing continually up in the high teens and even into the lower 20s. So Bill got out a grease pencil and wrote a little sign over the compass that said, "Do not sail on uphill water." So they were all able, eventually, to put the boat into a regime where it was always heading downhill. But in order to do that, they first had to get going very fast, so they would reach up with the spinnaker and then bear off in order to catch a wave at the right time and hop. Let's say they're on the port board, the wind coming in over your left ear as you're facing forward, and they would hop to the right. ride one wave at its fastest, and before climbing that wave ahead, turn right and catch the tail end of another one that was just beginning to develop that would keep the boat surfing continually. Now, this kind of thing drove the navigator nuts, of course. McCaig would, when each helmsman would come off watch, and incidentally, they found that they could only do this, they could only stand the tension for about half-hour helm tricks. And when one guy would come off watch, McCaig would ask him, pay no attention to the course, tell me where you've been. And after they'd hopped to the right for a while, they would have to jibe the spinnaker and hop to the left in order to stay fairly close to the course line 2,000 miles headed for Hawaii. Now, for sure, it took a lot of concentration to steer the boat like this, especially at night. I'm sure they had to watch for white horses in order to decide where to hop to. And they were all quite enthralled with this regime that they had put the boat into. And the off-watch would sometimes hang around in the cockpit and talk about what was going on. Holy smokes, they were really knocking out the miles. And they'd say things like, hey, there's the flank of the other one, right over there. Go over there, catch that one. People shouting orders at the helmsman, Bill Lee got out his grease pencil and finally wrote over the compass, shut up and steer. So that's the way they went for the next 9 days, knocking off a string of days of over 200 miles noon to noon. Well, they won the race, but there was a lot of yacht club politicking at the end because these guys were a bunch of mavericks from Northern California, and they had really shown their heels to the Southern California multi-hull yachting establishment, which was somewhat more elite. The trophy was awarded to John Marples and Bacchanal. John was eventually obliged to return the trophy and many years later got it back in an adjudication. And it was that kind of yachty, clubby, yucky, pucky that turned me and John off to ocean racing. He said at the start, I'm only going to do this once. And Christie's twisting my ear. I know I'm running overtime here, but there's another little bit of a story I'd like to tell about that particular race. Can you handle another few minutes? Here we go. As Bacchanal was streaking across the ocean with these guys standing half-hour helm tricks, there were five of them on board, and there were only four bunks, so McCaig figured out, finally figured out, wherever Bill Lee got up, that's where I went to bed. And one night as they were hopping and surfing, continually headed downhill, McCaig, the navigator, told him that, hey, they had just reached the halfway mark, and according to the radio communications, it looked like they were in a position to win this race if they could just keep it up. So they were having a little halfway party. Actually, four of the guys were sitting around in the stern castle, hand-stitching on a spinnaker. They had blown out one of their spinnakers, and they were stitching it up together by hand. And down there, smoking and joking, and the guy on the helm finally realized that his time was up, and so he pushed the hatch open and he hollered, hey, hey, it's my turn, you know, let me come down there and have a puff of that stuff. So his relief came up and took the helm in the middle of a mad surf, probably something in the vicinity of 20 knots, and it turned out that his sea runner, a 31-footer, was steered with a tiller, whereas Bacchanal was steered with a wheel. Well, this guy grabbed the wheel and corrected the wrong way and threw the boat into a mad broach. That means spinning out on the face of a wave. And Bacchanal was actually punched under edgewise on the face of the wave. One float driven underwater by a cascade from the other side so hard that water was pouring into the cockpit on the downwind side. Now, that's a little hard to believe because the cockpit is like 10 feet from the water in all directions. But there they were, broaching broadside on the face of an ocean wave with the chute up. And with great good fortune, the boat popped up. The cockpit was half full of water. It bailed itself out down through the centerboard trunk. The cockpit has very rapid self-bailing. And they took off again downwind. But they all sobered up in a big hurry. It was one close call. Well, that's the kind of thing that went on in the early multi-hull ocean racing scene. Nowadays, of course, the French in their 100-footers and more just go blasting through the waves without much regard to currents in the crests and all of that stuff. The 37-foot bacchanal, a backyard-built plywood box, really bracing in a 47 Ford, as Bill Lee called it, knocking off 200 miles a day. And now Joyon is down there going around the Southern Ocean at 870 miles a day. Come on. Think of the technical advance that has transpired just since the 1970s. So, in the meantime, here's to all the folks who have gone to sea in the name of multi-hull ocean racing. And here's to what it may mean to humankind as part of what I like to think of as the great green recovery. Fair winds,